Welcome to the best of the RSN Breakfast Club. Here's a little bit of what we did. Take a listen.
Adam White, I'm sure, would have been in front of the box last night watching the cricket in Abu Dhabi. Good morning to you, Adam.
Yeah, watched most of it. Missed the 4 wickets from Nathan Lyon.
Now, hold that story. I want to flesh that out. That is just funny stuff.
Not really.
No, it is. It's genuinely humorous. Hold it. It's because I saw that information you displayed to the public last night, and I laughed my guts out, I must admit. Sharon Whitman may or may not have seen it, but she's always good fun. Australia's greatest ever netballer joins us again. Good morning, Sharon.
Good morning. I haven't heard this story yet,
oh,
so
you're gonna
I'm
love this.
Cracking my fingers, all that didn't work, and getting ready for it.
You're going to love this.
Yeah, no, okay.
Not really.
Yeah,
oh.
Why don't you... Explain your story, please, Adam, because I laughed so hard. My wife said to me, "What the hell has happened to you?" It's one of those moments.
Are you okay?
Well, the test match starts every day at 5 o'clock. Now, the 5 to 7 zone, when you've got 3 kids under the age of 6 and a bit, that's a high pressure zone.
The witching hour.
The witching hour.
Well, that's 2 hours.
So there's dinner, there's bath, there's exuberant activity. There's all sorts of things going on in that
meltdown.
Range. And then the try to the, so the wind down, the milk, the in the night garden.
The view.
In
the night garden, it'll send you crazy anyway.
Oh, so anyway,
get rid of that stuff.
Jemima, our little 1-year-old, was a little bit cranky, and I'm trying to watch the cricket, and I'm trying to, you know. So the decision was made to put Yakka D on.
Who?
Do you know what Yakka D is? Yakka D. It's a children's television show which runs approximately 8 to 9 minutes.
It's a short burst type situation.
It's what you want from a children's show.
An episode was played, and in that time, Nathan Lyon took 4 wickets, and I missed all of them. It was just sort of meandering along. They had taken an early wicket. The Yakka D episode was put on.
Oh, but what? More importantly, what was it? A good episode?
Was it a good episode? That's important. That's
cool. a good episode.
Apparently, it was about a ball. But anyway, and my son Campbell, who I know I talk about a lot. He had cleverly gone into the other room to watch the cricket.
But hadn't.
And had just casually came out and said, "Hey, Dad, Nathan Lyon's just taken 4 wickets." I said, "What?" And I was in the other room watching Yakka D. I don't even know why I was watching it.
Of all the people.
Anyway.
Of all the people that I know to miss that 6 ball stretch where Nathan Lyon took four wickets for an edition of Yakka D. There is no one I would rather have that happen to than you.
Fair to say I was frazzled. I mean, what is going on? It's the first session. I'm not expecting this.
Oh, good. Well, no, I don't think anyone was expecting Nathan Lyon to get 4 and 6, it must be said.
But anyway.
The Yakka D complication did make my night, I must admit.
You're not onto Yakka D.
No. I feel like I should be. Now, if you're choosing that over Nathan Lyon taking 4 wickets in 6
holes. I didn't choose Yakka D.
I would avoid Yakka D if I can do that, Sherelle. Just avoid.
We'll try and get Andrew out the back to get the theme music. It's
we probably won't do that.
Tune.
No, we probably won't do that. Hey, McMahon, I was searching the interweb over the weekend, and all I saw was photos of you in garish get-up, a lot of fluoro activities, headbands and wristbands. What's going on with your world?
Yes,
you
didn't hear about this because you were off gallivanting last week.
Right.
But Netfest was on, which is a big participation tournament that Netball Australia runs. It was up on the Sunshine Coast. They have beach netball, which was literally on the beach in front of the Moolabah Surf Club there. So beautiful surroundings.
Next year they're going to Maui, are they? Beautiful place, just to change it up, change the dynamic a bit.
Why is that?
Well, I'm just trying to find the different venues that they might be able to use.
Okay, Maui.
Starts with M.
I don't think that they'll go to Maui next.
Well, that's a nice
I don't
place.
Think so.
Like
and
Maui.
As hey, Scotty so Gullen asked
that's
last
right.
week, the...
I love Maui.
The attire is not necessarily the same as beach volleyball, just to clarify that for anyone who's getting visions of what beach netball looks like. but it is a lot of fun. And you're talking about the party that we had, which was a themed party.
Right,
and
okay.
It was,
that makes sense.
80s aerobics theme. And
let's get physical activity. A bit of Olivia Newton-John.
Yes. And the 450 people who came to the party all got 450 were all in character and having a great time, and that included me.
Good for you.
Yes. Yeah, I led a bit up on the stage, I led a bit of, you know, 80s aerobic style, you know, grapevine. So
what a great show that was, aerobic style.
Oh,
what a great
loved
show.
Loved it. I loved sitting there eating my breakfast watching that.
For some reason, we did as well.
How
none
bizarre.
Of us ever moved.
No one ever did it.
That's a bloody good question.
No, but it was fun. It was a great tournament, and it was the first time it was on the Sunshine Coast, and it was a really good venue, and it is a great atmosphere. Everyone's there for a really fun time generally.
So it's basically a national footy trip for all netball clubs.
Pretty
is
much.
That right?
Pretty much.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
What a great idea.
Pretty much.
What a great idea.
Yeah, and it is a great idea. It's for you have to be 18 and over, so it is for that age group as well. So it's it's as I said, lots of fun.
Did I see too, just digressing a touch but staying within the realm, that the UK had a Fast Five thing going on? Shani and Ash Braz was
Over
there.
Yeah, they were
as well?
Over there doing that. Yeah, yeah. So actually coming up in a couple of weeks here in Melbourne, there's a Fast Five tournament where the top six nations in the world come and play a Fast Five style. So there's five players on the court instead of seven. There's a few different rules. There's 3-point shots and power plays where your points are doubled. And they had a similar thing in the UK just recently, but
right.
A club-based one.
Oh,
so
okay.
Shani Layton and a few other superstars are over there playing in that. So that's another thing to look forward to with netball.
Couldn't get on the Cashy there? Cashy train for you there?
No, apparently not.
On the commentary Cashy train?
I need to look into that.
I reckon you can. The decision to trade Tom Scully, the former number one draft pick, to the Hawks for a fourth round pick yesterday, which got certainly a lot of people in the world of football, both invested from a professional perspective in the media and also the public as well, talking about that situation. Sherelle, when you saw and heard the news that Tom Scully had been traded for a future fourth round pick, what did you think?
I thought that's a good deal for Hawthorn.
It's a good deal possibly a good deal for Hawthorn.
Yeah, it was a surprise for me, actually, in how it all played out. You seemed to delight in stirring things up a little bit on Twitter last night.
Well, just the outrage was hilarious because it wasn't so much what happened, it was the mechanism which seemed to get people up in arms. And the conversation from a lot of people in the industry was that, well, how come other clubs didn't get a chance to best the offer, to make a better offer to GWS Giants for Tom Scully? And that's a very, very silly conversation to have, because that's not how the system seems to be working at the moment.
No.
What's happening, and I will preface this by saying that I don't like the way it's happening. What's happening is players, as we know, are nominating a club, and they are dealing exclusively with that club. Dylan Scheel has chosen Essendon. Lachie Neal has chosen Brisbane. And they are dealing exclusively, his home club at the time, or their home clubs at the time, are dealing exclusively with those clubs. So there's actually, it's not an open market, so to speak. It is it's a really closed market. The player chooses where they want to go, and that's where the negotiations are had.
And is this an unexpected path that this has gone down? Do you think the AFL expected this, or is this a bit of a surprise?
Yeah, that's a really good question, I reckon. And just on that, because I would imagine when the whole premise of free agency was introduced, that they would have thought, headquarters and even the clubs would have thought, that there would have been a bit more of a bidding buyers sellers market for players, particularly in contract. Mm. Now, this is not free agency situation, these ones. These are players in contract. But one of the ramifications is that's what's happening now. You're right. They're just choosing one instead of opening it up to a field of teams who make the best bid, and then the deal's done.
Probably the only one that is doing that at the moment is Stephen May, who has said he now wants out of the Gold Coast. He actually doesn't care where he goes as long as he gets out of the Gold Coast and to a club in Victoria. So that's the first time where it's like, well, you bid for me. It doesn't really bother me. I want out. But all the others are nominating clubs, which I think is, in a way, is fair enough. But, you know, if I'm going to leave my club, this is the club I want to go to. I think the similarity, and it's been lost in the conversation a lot, Half, is the Tom Scully move to Hawthorn and the Dan Hannabry move to St Kilda. The difference is that Scully has gone to Hawthorn, who's been a dominant club for a long time, whereas Hanbury has gone to a non-threatening club, if you like, in St Kilda. But the similarities are that Hanbury has gone to St Kilda for a third-round pick, essentially. Scully, a fourth-round pick. But both of them are buy beware because both of them have got injury issues. Both of them are former All-Australians, so they both are very good players of similar age. But we've got a situation where Tom Scully has got a serious ankle problem. He injured it in round two. I know I've talked about this a bit this week, but he injured it in round two. In trying to get back for the finals, it wasn't right, so he's had to have further surgery, and he's no guarantee to be playing in the first bit of next year as it stands. Hawthorn, to get him to the club, it's not just that Scully said, hey, I want to go to Hawthorn because they're a good club. Hawthorn's offered a three-year deal plus a kicker of a fourth if all things go well. So he's given Hawthorn's given Scully the security that Scully thought, you know what, I want to go there because they want to look after me. They think they can get my ankle right. I've lost confidence in the Giants and in their ability to get my ankle right. Let's make the move. So I don't see there being any issue in that at all because there are similarities between the Hanbury and Scully situation.
Yeah, and the other thing is that the Giants clearly, and Jason McCartney said it in that grab, have some salary cap pressure, he called it. Now, it seems that there must be some significant pressure for them to be able to allow a guy like Tom Scully to be able to walk with that sort of deal. So there's a lot of layers and facets to this whole situation that it's not just Hawthorn trying to screw the system or the Giants just coughing it up, trying to get some back scratching, get back the other way down the track. This is about a unique situation with a guy who clearly was a number one draft pick, and that's what skews the conversation a little bit. Who's in a world of hurt with his ankle and may not play for quite some time. He may also as well if they can get him right. But there is a significant risk attached to the investment, and that's why Hawthorn are happy to pay a price, but not much of a price, and the Giants are happy to get rid of him because it's costing a lot of money. He's a very expensive asset that's non-performing at the moment. And clubs in their situation who have got those players who are expensive, underperforming assets have to make a call one way or the other how they deal with it. This was the easiest way for them to free up some space.
Absolutely. And when Hanbury went to St Kilda, they've offered him a five-year deal on massive money. Clubs that were never going to do what St Kilda did with Dan Hanbury. So that's why, again, it's a bit of a salary cap relief for the Swans as well. And that's why it's only a third-round pick or a fourth-round pick. The Giants one is really interesting. I don't think they should be necessarily heavily criticised for having a salary cap issue because I think they went for a premiership and they brought in Brett Deledio, they brought in Ryan Griffin, they brought in these senior guys because they thought, complementing the young emerging players they had a chance of winning a premiership. They reached two consecutive preliminary finals. They were a kick away from a grand final. I don't think they should be criticised for having a crack at it. Unfortunately, they came up short, and as a result of their tactic, they're now in a situation where they've got to move guys on to get the next young kids appropriately looked after because they've just got so many talented young players that need to be paid. So the guys like Tim Taranto, Aiden Bonner, these guys, they have to pay them. Otherwise, they'll walk after 2 years, essentially like Jack Scrimshaw has from the Suns to Hawthorn. So they're always going to be a team, I reckon, the Giants, between 4 and 10 because they've just got so much talent and they'll continue to have talent because when players go out, like has happened in this period, they're getting really good picks coming back in again.
And I think as Warren Treadrow said on Twitter yesterday, which I thought was quite astute, this is just another part of the industry now that's evolved, the salary dump trade.
Yep.
That's what it is. You get a good value prospect or player for not much because a team needs to get them off the books. This is just the evolution of the game, the way things have gone. It's uncomfortable for a lot of people. They don't like it because they don't seem to be getting full value, sort of market value, so to speak, for it. But the salary dump is becoming a huge factor in trade situations.
And it wasn't a secretive thing with Scully. There had been suggestions around for a month or so that Scully might be leaving the Giants or that he was available. Now, Hawthorn say that this has only really happened in the last sort of 10 days, but Scully had been linked to Essendon for a long time and a couple of other clubs that they were looking at him because they thought they could get him because of this disenchantment over the Giants and the way that they handled the ankle injury. So I don't think this was a secret cloak and dagger type of situation to look after another really good team. And there's that salary cap dumping and the pre-agency are the two new sort of buzz things in trade, and it's affecting it.
Duncan McKenzie McCarrick probably doesn't care too much about that at the moment. He is in Boston, my understanding, is living the dream, getting ready for the NBA season opener. That sounds like a nice place to be. Dunk, good morning.
Good morning, Hart. Good morning, Sherelle. Good morning, Whitey. It's a very crisp, chilly 10 degrees here in Boston. Afternoon, getting ready for this massive season opener between the Celtics and the Philadelphia 76ers.
It is. It is a massive. That's the appropriate term. It's because considering what happened with Philadelphia last year, the way they evolved as a team with this unbelievable talent they've got in their roster, and the way that Brett Brown was able to shape that, and the way they went out in the finals to the Celtics. I mean, it's a huge way to start the season for them. They'll be looking for, even though it's one of 82, some early season redemption, wouldn't they, the 76ers?
Absolutely, Harp. And especially with, you know, LeBron James moving west to join the Lakers. I mean, these two teams are now considered the best two teams in the East, as the Celtics really get back to full strength with the return of their top 10 player and Kyrie Irving, an all-star, and Gordon Hayward. And yeah, the 76ers would have been very disappointing with the way that Eastern Conference semi-final series ended. But it's a very exciting time in Boston. I mean, they finally get Hayward back after that sickening incident in the opening minutes of last season against the Cavs, which I'm sure all you guys remember, when he basically suffered that fractured tibia and dislocated ankle all in the one hit. He missed the whole year. Now it remains to be seen whether their star recruit, if he'll return to the court the same player he once was.
Well, and that's one of the great questions, I think, for the whole year, let alone if you're a Celtics fan, to see what Hayward can get back to. Irving's influence is going to be profound, you'd think, through the journey, and how they team up as a combination is going to be fascinating to watch. But the Hayward conversation and what he's able to deliver, considering the hype around him pre-season last year before he got injured, had that horrible injury, as you say. I mean, he was one of the biggest names in the game before he went down last year.
Yeah, he was. And the fact is, with him and Irving coming into the starting five now, half, they've really got to remodel or reshape the way in which they play, because, I mean, you had players like Jaylen Brown, Terry Rozier and Jason Tatum, who always do a whole new level during the playoffs and surprised a lot of teams and probably surprised Coach Brad Stevens. And all of a sudden, they bring these top two guys into their starting five. I mean, how do they fit this very deep roster into a starting five, and who's their best five? It's just questions Stevens left to answer pretty quickly.
We're all looking forward to seeing Ben Simmons get out there. I'm sure you are as well. There's been a little bit of talk about some of the gaps in his game. I know a couple of the big coaches over there have come out in defence of his ability to shoot from the perimeter. Is that a big story out there? How is he settling in, and what do you expect from his season this year?
Yeah, it's definitely a huge talking point here in the United States, Sherelle. I mean, there's no doubt that he can become an all-star this season. I mean, last season without a jump shot, I mean, he averaged 15 points, 8 assists, 8 rebounds in the regular season. But, yeah, that thing went really quiet during the playoffs, especially in that series against the Celtics, where Brad Stevens pretty much figured out how to guard him, you know, crowd the paint, give him space around the perimeter where he clearly wasn't going to shoot with that suspect jump shot, as you mentioned. So we know he's been working on that during the summer, Sherelle. I mean, he's been practicing with mentor LeBron James and has been really getting bigger and stronger in the gym. I mean, if he can start making mid-range shots on a consistent basis, I mean, he can definitely become one of the top 10 players in the league. There's no doubt about that.
And the other one we're looking forward to, of course, is Aaron Baines for Boston. What will he bring? I mean, he's obviously coming back into that team. What will it look like for him?
Yeah, well, especially with Irving and Hayward coming back into the starting five, it will be interesting to see what Stevens does again with Baines. I mean, he started most of last season, but then during the playoffs, Stevens went smaller, putting Al Horford in the centre and then Rozier, Tatum and Brown. Look, defensively, I reckon Baines probably had his best year last season. He was just this huge enforcer, 7-foot guy, protected the rim and the paint, and was a real leader on the court. I think it really just depends, Sherelle, if the coach wants to play a quicker, smaller, sort of run-and-gun style of game, or whether he continues to give Aaron big minutes by intimidating opponents under the basket. I mean, he is absolute brute of a man, this guy. So we'll have to wait and see whether he continues that role.
Boston is one of my favourite cities in the world. What's it like being there at the moment, where you've got the NBA season starting there, you've got the Red Sox in action? They're such a sports-mad town. What's it like?
Well, Boston's sports mad at the latest of times, Whitey, so let alone when you've got two of the biggest clubs and teams in the city going on at the moment, especially the Red Sox, which I think are probably still the city's favourite team, but there's just always such a massive buzz around the city, especially when the Red Sox are doing well. It's a huge buzz. I mean, I've just arrived here. I was lucky enough to go to school at Boston College, so I know what it's like to be around the bars at this time of year. And it's just a matter of time whether the Sox can get the job done and make it to a World Series in a couple of days' time.
You see, he had to just take it that one step too far, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Talk about living going to school in Boston.
He always can outdo me with the life that he's leading.
Well, it's hard to sort of find a way that you're on top at the moment.
No.
Although you are watching.
Come on, Wally. What's your next question, mate?
Yeah, he's checking out.
He's going to give you a question about Yakadee in a second, just to give him a one-upmanship type situation. Just on the Sixers, before we move on to the other conversation points we've got for you this morning. Jonah Bolden, we know he's there as well. Son of Bruce, we spoke to him earlier in the mid-year after the news that he picked up again by the 76ers after some time in Europe. And what's his likelihood of seeing much time this year, Jonah?
Oh, he'll see. Well, who knows? I mean, you never really know with these sorts of things because, you know, the Sixers, they're playing pretty deep as well. They still want to get a fair bit of time to their younger guys who were just coming in from last season as well. I think Jonah's probably in the third team, maybe. He's still on the active roster. I mean, I don't think he's going to get demoted to the G League. I think he's going to be playing some minutes. It's just a matter of how many minutes he plays.
Right, well, we'll keep an eye on that. Now, in the NFL, why do you have been watching this yesterday?
We talked glowingly about Tom Brady yesterday with what he did in the game against Kansas City. But then Aaron Rodgers, he's been in amazing form. Another 400-yard game last night, multiple touchdowns, no interceptions, and Green Bay came from behind to win.
Yeah, well, that was about as much as you can get. You know, from a guy who, alongside Brady, who's probably... he's been the best quarterback in the NFL for the past 8 or so years. I mean, he was amazing, wasn't he? I mean, that penultimate drive when the Packers were down 23-30, when Rodgers had the ball with a couple of minutes left and just threaded some incredible passes to his receivers. I mean, he helped tie the game at 30 each, and then with less than 90 seconds left, he gets the ball back at his own 10-yard line. I mean, he said in the post-match that he was just hoping to at least make it to overtime, but once again, I mean, as cool as ever against the pass rush, connecting a number of times with Devontae Adams. There's no doubt the Niners got sloppy. I mean, their defense left way too much space for Rodgers to go wide, to find his receivers and get the ball out of bounds to save a fair bit of time on that play clock. But it was a masterclass, wasn't it? And that drive set up Mason Crosby, who had a crack at a 27-yard field goal to win the game. And, you know, Crosby, this is a player who's coming off one of the worst games ever as a kicker last week. I mean, he missed 4 field goals against the Lions. He was absolutely lambasted by the Packers faithful. And then Crosby ends up kicking the game winner. So, what a game of redemption. Green Bay wins it 33-30. The other thing Whitey to remember is, I mean, the Packers heading for their bye week. It's 3 wins, 2 losses and a tie. So they aren't going that great. And they now come up against this huge run of games. They face the undefeated Rams in LA, and then they've got the Patriots at Gillette Stadium. But then after that, they've got the Miami Dolphins, who have really been a surprise packet this year, currently co-leading the AFC East. So if the Packers are going to be fair dinkum in this season, we'll soon find out a fair bit about them in the next month or so.
Can we take a look forward to the Major League, the baseball? It's getting into the important part of the year. We obviously spoke about the Red Sox. What's the update on what's going on there?
Well, 2 massive league championship series going on at the moment, Sherelle. Obviously, we've got the Boston Red Sox with the best record in baseball up against the defending champion Houston Astros. And that series is tied at 1-1. Game 3 is about to get underway in about just over an hour's time in Houston. The other really interesting one is the National League Championship Series going on at the moment between the Dodgers and the Milwaukee Brewers. Of course, the Dodgers got all the way to the World Series, fell 1 win short of winning their first World Series since 1988 last season. They've made it to the Final 4 again. But they're sort of really getting shown up by the Milwaukee Brewers at the moment, who had a fantastic game yesterday in LA at Dodger Stadium. I mean, they basically kept the Dodgers scoreless, and they did for up until the bottom of the ninth. The Dodgers got 3 runners on base, and then Cody Bellinger popped one up, and they couldn't really get the tying run. They couldn't really hit the grand slam. So the Brewers lead the Dodgers 2-1 in the National League Championship Series. The Game 4 is at Dodger Stadium in about 3.5 hours' time. I'll tell you what, if the Brewers can steal Game 4, they'll take a 3-1 lead back to Milwaukee. And who knows, they might be on the verge of winning their first ever World Series title.
We always love chatting to the coach of the Australian Diamonds. She's a very good supporter of our program, and hopefully she thinks we are of her as well. She's back again. Lisa Alexander, good morning.
Good morning.
Nice to have you on board. Now tell me, Elise, what happened on the weekend? We were in full control in the Australian League of this Constellation Cup, but we travel overseas, we get in the plane, and all of a sudden things change.
Yes, they do change, and that's what, you know, is inevitable about sport. Every contest has its own script, and I think what Australian netball fans need to understand when you come over to New Zealand, it is a little bit different, and you know, I think that crowd support that we had in Australia really helped to lift us, and this new group have to get used to the fact that they've got to fight it out when we're over here in the Kiwi land and everyone's against us.
Well, there was another difference, Lise, too, in the amount of penalties that the girls received. We actually had about double what the Silver Ferns did on the weekend. Was that a change in what the athletes were doing, or do you think it was a change in the umpire interpretation?
Yeah, certainly what happens, and I think this is also important that people understand, we have a system of umpiring where the international umpires have coaches, and that changes from country to country. So there can be just a slight difference in interpretation and the way that the umpires go about their work. And look, it is tough. We're not, you know, we're not going to whinge about it because we know we have to adjust to it and we're used to that happening, but I think it was a fairly distinct change. I think at one stage it was 12 penalties to zero in the first quarter. So, but we've just got to adjust, and that's part of our learning as a team, and we know that we're going to have to do that on Thursday night.
The other thing that was quite distinct over the last couple of games is the tactics of the use of players. New Zealand have basically had the same starting seven across the two matches, while you and the Diamonds have used a lot of the bench, a lot of changes throughout those couple of games. Talk us through your kind of thinking around that, because that is something that you have wanted to do with this group over the last period of time, and how that works with the players moving on and off the court.
Yeah, look, we've been doing this for quite some time. We've got 12 fantastic athletes in our group, and, you know, we need to use all of their skills and strengths and talents to help nullify the opposition. But clearly, you know, we know on Sunday that it didn't work to our advantage. So we'll go back to the drawing board a little bit with that. We know we've got to secure a win on Thursday night, and we'll be putting out what we think is our best seven out on court in that first quarter, as we did the other day too, because I can tell you that Caitlin and Gretel were playing very well together and showed in the Brisbane test how well they could play, and they deserved their start. But sometimes things don't just work out for you. And, you know, we know we've got to explore what we've got as well, because we've only got a certain amount of time to look forward to World Cup.
So does that mean, Lisa, there's times where you've almost got to be prepared to take the hit in exploring what you've got and look at a longer-term picture, or is there no excuse for not winning every game you play?
Absolutely no excuse, and it's not a... I'll say it again, our athletes are top-notch. They're the best of the best, and we expect that no matter who goes out there, that they're still going to win. And we'd seen some great training form from Steph and Gretel in Shooter. So, you know, we felt that that would give the opposition something to think about as well. So, you know, it didn't work. We know that. So we'll have a look at that strategy and go back to perhaps a more settled lineup on Thursday.
What are we going to do about Maria Folau?
Yes. She's bombing them, Lise. We can't stop the bombs.
Yeah, look, we've got some plans in place for her too, but we've also got to stop the supply to her. I think we didn't put enough pressure on her outside of the circle. She played like a goal attack, goal shooter at times. So we can't go away from our method of really getting up in her face and really hassling her, even if she's in shooter. So a bit more physical presence around her just to make it very uncomfortable for her, even when she's playing shooter.
And talk to us about what the win meant for New Zealand netball. We saw them struggle massively at the Commonwealth Games. They were embarrassed by the performance and were under an enormous amount of pressure and scrutiny over there. Have we let them off the hook a little bit by giving them that, not giving them that win, but by them having that win?
Yeah, look, of course we have. There's no other way to say it. But, you know, the New Zealand team, and I've talked to the media over here as well, they've been improving in every match. In every match we've played them, even though we've had those score lines, they've had periods of really top-notch connection. And so we've got to pay tribute to them too. They have improved. The players are playing their roles, and they're really putting that energy and effort and passion into it. And if we're slightly off our game, what happened to us on Sunday will happen. So we certainly reminded our group about having to knuckle down and get that intensity back out there.
What Nolan Taru has been brought into to the team. You've been saying that they've been improving. As the coach taking the reins, what do you see that she has brought to this group? Because there's been a lot of talk. The players are clearly responding to her. What do you see out on court as the difference that she's brought?
Oh, look, I think there's just a resolve in the group that they, you know, have to keep working at things, and it's not always going to be pretty, but they've got just that little bit more mental toughness, I think, around grinding out and knowing that, you know, they need to stick to their guns and things will turn around. And I think, you know, that's certainly what they showed on Sunday.
Will you have a different seven starting on Thursday night, Liz?
Most likely, yes.
In which areas most likely will we see biggest change?
I won't be saying anything. You know, I don't give opposition. There's plenty of Kiwis that live in Australia that, you know.
They're all listening on the app.
That's what I don't understand. I don't understand why Kiwis that live in Australia that are Australian citizens barrack for the All Blacks. It's just not on.
It just doesn't make sense.
Were you going to say something?
No, I was going to say before Lisa goes, we've got to ask her about the steal, Tom Scully to Hawthorn. What are your thoughts on this?
Oh, yes.
Look, I was waiting for the Hawthorn question.
Well, it didn't come from me,
I've been monitoring it very closely over here, I can tell you. We've got one of the actual Hawthorn doctors is working with us, Dr. Liam West. So we've been discussing all the trading that's been going on. So, yeah, no, I'm really rapt that Hawthorn have got Scully. I think it's exciting and it's probably just what we need.
Would you play him in wing defence or wing attack?
I reckon I'd play him at centre.
Centre, would you? Righto.
Yeah, I would.
Chad Wingo would be a GA. He'd be GA written all over.
I know, wing attack, get him up high, get him back into the circle, just outside the circle. Lise, we wish you the best of luck on Thursday night. It's been a good performance. We had a bit of a glitch on the weekend, but hopefully back on track on Thursday in the last game on the Consolation Cup.
We're going to hit back hard, half.
The Sail GP this weekend and the Sydney Harbour. Now, I don't know, didn't know too much about this until I was handed some information yesterday to read up on this, but one man who knows more about this than all of us combined is Tom Slingsby. You might remember him as a gold medalist at the 2012 London Games in the laser class. He's been good enough to join us to talk about this and what it exactly means for the world of sailing. Tom, good morning.
Good morning.
Great to have you on, mate. Love talking to gold medalists in any pursuit, and it's great to have you as part of this, but tell us about Sail GP. What is it?
Sail GP, it's a new league which Larry Ellison and Russell Coutts have formed, and it's essentially very similar to the boats used in the last America's Cup in Bermuda. It's a nation-versus-nation league, and, yeah, we've got an Australian team, and we're going to be competing against the likes of USA, UK, France, China and Japan, and the first event starts in February. First event will be in February on Sydney Harbour.
So it's all inshore racing, and I think that's one of the issues, one of the things that needs to be highlighted, because it's a fan engagement type series. So they tell me that it's all inshore racing, it's everyone's close and able to see what's happening, and you're all racing the same boats. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. So all the boats are identical, so it'll come down to the skill of your team. And, the racing's very, very close to shore. We'll be kicking in and doing manoeuvres right next to the shore, and at the speeds we're going, it's very spectacular.
Well, I was going to ask you about the speeds, because you're getting up to around 100 clicks an hour, aren't you?
Yes. The boats now, wind power alone. These new boats will be doing about 95 k's an hour on the water.
What's that like when you're out on the water? Is it a bumpy ride? Is it smooth? Does that extra speed kind of change the experience?
Obviously, we're up on hydrofoils now. That's the way we've been able to get this speed, is going up on hydrofoils and getting rid of the drag of the hulls in the water. And it can be a very bumpy ride if you're not doing a good job of controlling your foils. But in general, it's pretty smooth. You fly over choppy water and you see a powerboat next to you sort of bouncing around and having a tough time. And we go pretty flat straight through it. And hence why we're going to be doing about 53 knots, which is about 95 k's an hour. And there's no boat on Sydney Harbour that could do that sort of speed in choppy water. So it's, if we break the law, we can actually get away from the police boats, which is
nice. I like it.
So representing Australia, obviously you do it at the Olympics, but to do it in something like this, how special is that, Tom?
It's really special for me. It's obviously, I haven't really competed on the world stage for Australia since London 2012, and I've been overseas competing in the America's Cup where there hasn't been an Australian team competing. And now with the formation of this new league, I have that opportunity, and I've been really fortunate that I've been able to pick the team and get all the guys I know who are great sailors from around the world and competing for other teams around the world and bring them back to Australia. So we've got 100% Australians on board, and we'll be competing against other countries with 100% nationality.
I'm interested in winning an Olympic gold medal and how it has changed you as a person, because we often talk to athletes, you know, whether it be track and field or some of the more prominent sports, about what it's like. But for you, I'm interested because sailing, when we come to an Olympic Games, we almost rely on sailing to be successful for us, and then we don't hear too much about them in between Olympic Games. What's the journey been like for you?
Obviously it was a bit of a shock to the system. I sort of had my head down working for 10 years before London, and then to win, and I think we had a bit of a drought before that, so it was quite a lot of publicity that I'm definitely not used to.
Yeah.
But then I came back to Australia. I was only in Australia for about a week before I had to move overseas. I moved to San Francisco for an America's Cup bid straight after, so I didn't really have any of that at all, and it all sort of blew over, and on to your next Olympics and gold medalists. And for me, nothing really changed. As I said, a week later, I was full-time racing for another team and on to the next challenge. When I'm retired, I'll look back at my accomplishments and hopefully have a smile on my face. But at the moment, I'm trying to achieve goals that I want to achieve.
Where do you keep your Olympic gold medal?
I'm hoping my parents still have it in safekeeping. I haven't seen it in a while, but I'm hoping there I can trust them with it, which I have for the last 6 years.
Pop in for a cup with Mum. She'd love it. Just wear it with the Scotch finger. You love it. Just further to Whitey's question about Olympics sort of bringing sailing to front of mind and then it disappears for a bit, how important is this sort of format to keep sailing front of mind for sports lovers?
That's exactly what it is. It's with the Olympics, it's every 4 years. With the America's Cup, it's every 4 years, and we didn't have an Australian team. People really get into it when we do pop up and on the scene, but this is an annual circuit. We're going to, next year, we're going to have the first events in Sydney, then we go to San Francisco, New York, the UK, France, and it's an annual circuit. From there, that's 5 events next year. We're going to look to make more events the year after, maybe 6 or 7 events. So this keeps sailing in the eye of the spectators, and it's been a huge problem for sailing in the past, is we get all this traction and a lot of new fans, but then they don't see it again for years. So hopefully this is going to change that. That's why I think it's really going to be a successful league.
Can I take you back just a little while to the America's Cup? You were with Team Oracle. You were down 8-1 in the final against New Zealand, and it was one of the most incredible sporting events and moments that I've ever seen. You came back and won from 8-1 down, and I've heard you talk about the fact that your boat was getting faster. Can you explain how that happens? How does your boat get faster every time that you come up again, you know, as you're going through that process?
Yeah, so it's a long process to build up to an America's Cup. Basically, we put all our trust in the designers. We don't get to line up with other teams. Other teams, basically, we all go do our own thing and trust in our own design path that we're doing the right thing. And then finally, when the America's Cup starts, all the Louis Vuitton, the preliminary rounds, teams actually start to go against other teams and go and realise, oh, my God, we're not as quick as them. We've made a mistake. So then you have a list of, basically you have a contingency plan, and we're saying, okay, if we are not as quick as Team New Zealand, this is what we're going to roll out, and hopefully this will make the boat better and better and better. And so you go in with what you think is a 100% package. You really never know what is right until you line up with other teams. So when we were losing to Team New Zealand, they were getting 1-0 down, 2-0, 3-0, 4-0, and they were starting to beat us. We're like, okay, let's roll this out, and hopefully this will change the boat and get it better. We were rolling things out at about 2 or 3-0 down and and they weren't making the boat quicker, but then we stumbled across some things that were. And honestly, a lot of it, once we got to a boat that was very similar speed, it was a confidence thing, and the races could have gone either way. We were 8-1 and our backs were against the fence when the boats were pretty even. And so we fortunately got through those really tough races, and then we sort of had by then realised this design path that we're on to improve the boat was working. And we made a few more steps and became a faster boat. And, yeah, as long as we didn't make mistakes, we knew we'd win the races. And, slowly but surely we got back to 8-7, 8-all, and won the final race, 9-8, which is an amazing feeling.
Yeah, it was an incredible chase down. It was one of the most amazing things I've seen in sport. But will Australia ever be back in the America's Cup, do you think? Will we ever have another boat?
For sure, we will be. It's such a shame that we're not there now, because I obviously finished the last America's Cup in Bermuda, and I told my bosses, Larry Ellison and Russell Coutts, that I'm going to take some time to try to get an Australian team funded and in the America's Cup. I'm a sailor. I'm not a money raiser at all, but I did my best, and I had some great people helping me, but we weren't able to raise enough money. I mean, we're talking over $100 million to really race competitively. We could go with the money we had, we could have competed, but you're just making up the numbers if you don't have the money to put into the design and the technology. And if the athletes realise that you're an underfunded team, they won't sign, the top athletes won't sign with an underfunded team. So we decided not to go forward. And hopefully in the future, the costs of running America's Cup campaign are going to come down, and Australia can throw their hat in the ring again and be successful again.
Now, we talk a bit of golf on this program, and Oliver Goss is a name we have mentioned through the last couple of years. Had some big performances, but he's also the subject of one of the most intriguing stories and situations I've come across of recent times. He's been good enough to join us on The Breakfast Club this morning. Good morning, Ollie.
Oh, thanks for having us on the show, guys.
Great to have you on. I was just scrolling through Twitter and saw a tweet come up that said you're turning your back on the professional career as a player and you're going to become a coach. What's happened there?
Yeah, it's kind of been it wasn't a decision I made overnight, that's for sure. And there was a lot of, it took a long time to come to that decision. I had to think about a lot of different things. And, you know, it's a very complicated answer if you wanted me to kind of break down why. But, yeah, there's a lot goes into it. A lot to do with finances and, I just wasn't enjoying, playing competitively anymore. I still love golf and want to play golf. I just wasn't enjoying competing. And it probably accrued and got worse and worse and worse over the last couple of years. But, yeah, so now I've decided to go down more of the coaching route, so I'm back in Perth to complete the bridging course with the Oz PGA. So I'm hoping to get started the next month or so.
It's a brutal game. You've been based in America now for a little while, and you've been playing on the web.com tour, and we'll sort of reflect back on a few of the highlights through the time. But we speak to a lot of golfers on our program, and they share with us the realities of being a professional golfer, and it's not necessarily all sort of bright lights. It can be really quite difficult.
Yeah, you know, it's it's always a lot more difficult than people may assume. You know, there's a lot more that goes into it. You know, you tell people you're a professional golfer and they automatically think you're a millionaire when that's far from the truth. But even lots of other things, you know, just dealing with being away from home a lot and traveling and expenses. And, you know, they think that your sponsors kind of cover all of your travel, but you've kind of got to fork that up yourself. But, yeah, it's always a lot more that goes into it than people may think. And I don't want to complain that, you know, being a professional golfer was hard. I mean, it can be, but, you know, I was doing what I always wanted to do and dreamed of doing since I was a little kid. I guess it just wasn't what I thought it would be, you know.
It's amazing, Ollie, that at 18 or 19, certainly a teenager, you won the Western Australian Open as an amateur in your home state. The next year, you're runner-up in the US amateur to Matt Fitzpatrick, who's now one of the best players in the world. You kind of had your world at your feet. What were you thinking at that time about what golf was going to be to you?
You know, looking back on it, I probably thought that it was just going to kind of continue on that, you know, linear path and just get better and better and better. And that, you know, obviously didn't end up happening, even though I was working way, way harder each and every year to try and get better. But yeah, it just didn't come to fruition. But for sure, at the time, I thought things were going to be, you know, the world was going to be at my feet kind of thing.
You played in the Masters in 2014 and you made the cut. What was that experience like? Was it like a dream?
Oh, definitely not like a dream. I can still remember almost everything about that week, and it was easily the best week of my life to date. So I definitely, you know, there's a lot of good memories there that I always look back on. You know, it was my 20th birthday on the Saturday, and that was the one goal that I wanted to achieve, was to make the cut and play on my birthday. And it was just such an awesome week, and I can always, you know, look back on that, you know, when I'm an old man. So, yeah, it was the best week of my life.
What about the moments playing on the PGA Tour and getting to meet Jack Nicklaus? How do you look back on those moments?
You know, at the time, I probably took it for granted a little bit, the opportunity I was given. But I definitely appreciated it. I was super lucky to get that opportunity to play in those PGA Tour events. But I think for sure I took it for granted. I think anyone would be in that situation. They have no idea, you know, the opportunity they've been given until a few years down the line. But it was a great experience. It did, you know, it made me realise I do have the potential to play with those guys. And I think, you know, there's thousands of players that do. You know, it's not just those guys that play on the tour that can play on the tour. There's thousands of golfers that can. The difficult thing is to actually get there and, you know, do it.
Yeah, good. And I guess do it week in, week out, and that consistency to just keep doing it, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, Ollie, I'm interested from the point of view, I remember following you around at Metropolitan in the Australian Masters when you'd come back from America and there was all this hype around you. And I remember I certainly got swept up in it. I wanted to see, you know, how good you were. How was that dealing with a young man in yourself, all the hype about this could be the next big thing in Australian golf? Was that difficult, or as a youngster, do you embrace that and get excited by it?
Well, to be honest, I didn't realise there was all that hype. I thought I was just another guy coming back to play some golf in Australia. So, you know, I just went into every tournament with the same mentality. I wasn't trying to impress anyone. You know, there are pressures there like that, you know, pleasing your sponsors and pleasing the people that have supported you and, like, the Australian golf fans and stuff like that. But I didn't think there was all this hype around me, that's for sure.
Well, you did very well. You sort of kept it obviously in a bubble, and you weren't sure what was going on around you. What about with the whole idea of this, the web.com tour, and the amount of good players that are on tour? And you know, Cam Percy, we speak to him a fair bit on the show, and he talks about some of the crazy scores you need to post just to make the cut, just to try and make some money out of it. How difficult is it for not just yourself but any young Australian golfer trying to make it as a professional player?
You know, the web tour is, you know, it's pretty brutal, you know, and I really feel for the older guys that have families and stuff, because it's insanely tough to support not just yourself, but, you know, other people playing on the web tour, you know. And I remember in my first year, I think there were 6 weeks in a row where the cut was 5 or 6 under.
Yeah.
And there was definitely a few times where I shot 5 under and missed the cut by one shot. So, you know, I remember one tournament, a guy shot 28 under to win, and, you know, you're shooting 14, 15 under for 4 rounds, which is respectable anywhere else in the world, and you're not cracking the top 30, and you're, you know, essentially losing money for the week when you talk about expenses versus prize money and stuff. So the web tour is really tough because those guys are super talented. They might not have the best swings in the world, but they can get their ball in the hole, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's a good way of putting it, actually. So at 24, for young golfers that are listening to this interview now, would have you done anything differently? And have you got any advice for those young golfers that have maybe just about to turn pro and you know, I guess everyone wants to play in America? What would have you done differently, and what would your advice be?
I haven't really thought about it too much, but I don't think I would do too much different. You know, I know I worked hard and put the work in, and I did everything that I thought I needed to do in order to get to the next level. You know, practicing hard, going to the gym, eating the right stuff, doing my daily drills and all that kind of stuff. So it's definitely an individual thing. You know, some players respond better to other aspects of, you know, training and golf and all that kind of stuff. So I think it's entirely up to that person. So it's kind of difficult to answer. But for me, I know I did as much as I could, or, you know, I put a lot of effort in. So, yeah, it's not easy. Remaining positive is a huge part of it, because it's such a grind, and it always will be.
Do you still like golf, Ollie? Do you still like playing? I know you're going to go into coaching, but with the experiences you've gone through, do you like getting the clubs out and having a hit?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I went up to my home club, Royal Fremantle, last night and played holes for the first time in about 3 months, and I played a lot better than I thought I would, which was a surprise to me, but I really enjoyed it. I went up there with my dad and my best mate and a couple other friends from the golf course, and we had a great time, you know, just, you know, having a bit of banter around the course, and it was great fun. It's something I definitely miss, being in Australia, something I didn't have over in America.
Magic Door from the Kangas has had some sort of year with the boys in the Royal Blue and White Stripes. Good morning, Madge.
Good morning, guys. How are you going?
We're going very well. Thank you, buddy. The wash-up from the season with the Kangaroos, you've had a huge impact yourself and the way you were able to perform throughout the year. What does it do for your projections about what you should be doing next year in 2019?
I guess what it means for me is just having a really clear pre-season going into 2019. I know what my position looks like. I know what I need to do. I understand our defense structures and how some of my teammates play. I guess the last sort of 8 weeks of the season, I felt really comfortable playing down back, and guys were able to back me in. And I guess I'll be looking to play from right from the start, and not sort of wait and see how I go. Looking to contribute to the team straight away. So no, I'm really excited about that.
I would imagine that you wouldn't really be wanting a break, because you were so good in that second half of the year. The momentum that you were building, you would want to have just kept playing.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been nice to play some finals footy. And I speak about the continuity. That's what I had this year. String some games together, and I look really comfortable towards the back end of the year. And it was just really disappointing. Couldn't quite make it. But I guess that's the exciting part for next year. I think the boys at the footy club traded really well. Got some good talent in, and hopefully that can take us to the next step. So should be a good season next year.
Magic, I wanted to ask you about soccer just for a second. No doubt you saw Awa Mabel and Thomas Deng make their debut for the Socceroos just recently. Two boys who are from families who have immigrated from Sudan. Is that something that really resonates with you? Are you really looking to those guys and seeing what an incredible achievement that is?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, only playing footy, I mean, it's fantastic. But for them, they, you know, Aware and Thomas in particular, I've met those guys. I've met Thomas before, and I've had a bit to do with Thomas. He plays at Victory. You know, making the national squad and playing for your country is a great achievement in itself. But then the other great thing about it is, you know, he's a fellow countryman.
That was the best of The Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.